Studios.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. And now,
he is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, nobody died in that huge fire that has consumed over 10,000 acres near Spokane. Thank God for that. But about 850 homes have been lost. About 65,000 people had to be evacuated from the area, at least temporarily, most of them. Although some of them who have been forced out of those homes, who knows when they're going to be able to go home. But if this were to happen, because we know it happens far too often, when there is one of these wildfires that is deliberately set, and it appears that at least one of the major fires in Spokane was deliberately set, appears they have arrested a man, they have brought charges against him. We will see what the evidence is. Should convicted arsonists who intentionally cause deadly wildfires, the ones that actually caused death, the one in Spokane, thank God, did not, should they face the death penalty? The question was posed by my executive producer, and that's Mackenzie Prunty. Great idea. Should convicted arsonists who intentionally cause deadly wildfires face the death penalty? I think they should. The answer to that is yes. Think about the Palisades fire that actually did take lives in the early part January of last year down in California. When you've got an intentionally set fire and it does cause the loss of human lives, I think when they convict somebody of that, they should face the death penalty. Our poll on X can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. But the second question that I wanted to ask you about, and then we'll get to your phone calls and emails. When states like Oregon and Washington see millions of acres burn every single year. And then they see Idaho, which instead takes decisive action on wildfires, should they be taking notes and maybe changing course? Let me give you a great example of that, and then I'll get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Governor Brad Little, and the Portland Tribune has this story, Idaho Governor Brad Little signed a wildfire disaster emergency. That was Tuesday of this week. He deployed the Idaho National Guard to help fight what's called the Big Grass Fire that's burning along the border of Oregon and Idaho. Now, that's exactly what any governor ought to do. And you say, well, that's not unusual. Actually, it is, because in past years, we've watched as Oregon and Washington governors have taken ineffective action, or in some cases even ignored fires when they were small and allowed them to become big. Now, the one in Spokane blew up so quickly after part of it was deliberately set, it appears, that I'm not sure that acting quickly would have made a difference. But what the real tragedy is when you hear about fires that start out at a quarter of an acre, and in many cases, we hear excuses from politicians who say, well, but that fire is burning in wilderness, and so we don't want to go and put it out. Or that fire is burning in some other government's jurisdiction. These folks get all concerned about whether or not is that fire burning on national forest land, national park land, national monument land, BLM land. Is it burning on county forest land? Is it burning on state forest land? They get themselves all wrapped up in whose responsibility it is. It's like talking to small children. Whose socks are sitting in the middle of the living room? Well, they're not mine. Well, I didn't drop them there. They belong to Johnny. I mean, it really is ridiculous when you consider the way that politicians do not simply act by saying, there's a fire, let's go put it out. But the Big Grass Fire shows what fire officials called extreme fire behavior with rapid rates of spread. It has burned about 300,000 acres in Oregon and Idaho. That was as of yesterday afternoon. Containment was about 7%. As of Wednesday, the Big Grass Fire threatened more than 350 residential structures. BLM and then California Interagency Incident Management Team are responding to the fire. But they're there to put this thing out. And that's the thing that I think is missing in both Oregon and Washington, because you have government agencies that, for whatever reason, have decided because they think that fire is natural. It is, but who wants it in your neighborhood? Fire's natural, so's anthrax, so is smallpox. The fact that something is natural does not necessarily mean it's good. Is it a good idea to put these things out when you possibly can and do it as quickly as you possibly can? And should we have some tougher penalties when people go out and set some of these fires? As I said, thank God so far, the Spokane fire appears not to have taken a single human life, not even anybody seriously injured in that case. But when we do have those fires, and they do happen, I give you Palisades in California as a great example, when somebody intentionally sets a deadly wildfire, and it takes human lives or a human life, should that person actually face the death penalty? Now, it will ultimately be up to a jury and a judge and the system about whether or not you actually bring the death penalty against somebody. But the penalty ought to be available so that when you see those terrible situations and somebody has done something that causes human life to be lost, the jury and the judge ought to have the option of applying the death penalty. Let's go to Michael in Klamath Falls. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just want to point out the fact that the U.S. Forest Service, they just drive around all day out in the woods. And most about 95% of them are on the highway, and they're not actually out in the woods without a little spot of dust on them. I'm just kind of wondering what their role is about helping prevent these fires. It seems like they're very ineffective for how large their bureaucracy is.
I think you are right. And I know there are people in the Forest Service who say, oh, we do a fantastic job. But I'd point this out, Michael. The fact is the Forest Service used to generate net revenue to the U.S. Treasury decades ago. In the most recent decades, they actually cost more money than they produce, even though they manage a total of 198 million acres of forest. Those are all trees owned by all of us and managed by the government. Now, how could you take an asset like that and lose money? Because the Forest Service has 30,000 or so true believers who are environmentalists. They're tree huggers. They believe that when a fire starts in a forest, you should let that fire burn. That's absolute insanity. And it used to be that our national forests were for what the agency itself called multiple use, meaning it was for fishing, it was for hunting, it was for camping, it was for hiking, it was for mining, it was for logging, it was for all of those other purposes. And I think the Forest Service has lost its way. And if they actually had the same mission as, say, some of the private landowners, you go out and compare how the U.S. Forest Service does compared to private timber companies that manage their own land. Do you see the private timber companies letting their forests burn down every single summer? No. They're out there actively managing those forests and making sure they don't burn down. Our poll on X today: should convicted arsonists who intentionally cause what turn out to be deadly wildfires, should they face the death penalty? Back in a moment with the Northwest Nonsense. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Revolution Dental.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Hey, I've got a question for you. Can anybody tell me why Portland is not clued into the fact that it has Blazer team owner Tom Dundon over a barrel and not the other way around? And I'll plead guilty that I thought that Tom Dundon had the city over a barrel, although I wasn't arguing that the city or the state should pony up a gigantic pile of money to benefit Tom Dundon. The only threat that Dundon can use to extort two-thirds of $1 billion for renovation of the Moda Center is that he could move the team, and that's true. Only now we know, and I have to give full and lavish credit to the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, OregonLive.com, that the NBA would impose a relocation fee on Dundon, and that fee is estimated to cost as much as $1 billion, but probably no less than $850 million. Now, why is that significant? Well, why not call Scrooge McDundon's bluff? Go ahead, Tommy, move your team to Tennessee. And when it costs you a cool $1 billion that you and your partners likely don't have, you're going to wish you'd at least offer to go 50-50 on that Moda renovation. Meanwhile, consider the object lessons that taxpayers have learned through this whole mess. A feckless trust fund idiot, Ted Wheeler, former mayor, put taxpayers on the hook by buying the Moda for a dollar only 2 years ago. A governor election. Tech ponies up a third of $1 billion in taxpayer cash while at the same time simultaneously claiming that she's so short of cash she can't actually serve the needs of citizens at ODOT. Now, if that makes sense to you, I'd be glad to hear the naysayer call that explains it. A city council willing to blow north of $100 million while Portland says it can't afford to get the cops to emergencies in less than 20 minutes because of staffing. You know, it must have taken a full turnip truck to drop this whole bunch off at the Rose City. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and answer our X poll. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X and also on my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. So, Kurt writes in, Lars, we have a failing socialized program called Social Security. As the population declines and the workforce drops with free handouts, so does the funding for Social Security. The same thing is going to happen with all socialized government-sponsored programs. I'm 20-plus years away from Social Security. I've been paying in for the last 27 years. I've seen everything the government subsidizes to make it affordable ends up destroying the economy and destroying free market capitalism. Then the government-elected representatives ask for more in taxes and fees to balance it out. As a public servant, we got a decent cost of living increase of 6.5%. 2 months later, the governor and the lawmakers increased the income tax by 8%. So in reality, it was a 1.5% pay cut. All I see is more free programs that the radical left pushes, the more I'm robbed of my hard-earned paycheck, making it impossible to live, let alone get ahead and look forward to retirement. Signed, Kurt. Kurt, I think you've analyzed that very, very well. And my favorite post on X today, the Portland Trailblazers should immediately blaze a trail right out of Portland, as Oregon is ablaze with wildfires and all the wrongisms. The city had the worst air quality in the world today, a real tourism tragedy. Thanks, Tina. Oregonians should not be taxed for Moda Center fixes. And those who benefit from using the arena should foot the cost of maintaining and renovating it. Otherwise, let it Lloyd Center, and may the owners of other people's money let it crumble, let it fall, let it be a testament to all of us. Bad decisions have consequences. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give the Daily Grill collectively to both the state governments of Oregon and Washington. Why? One specific reason, the Education Freedom Tax Credit. What is the Education Freedom Tax Credit? Well, it's part of the One Big Beautiful Bill that was passed by the Congress about a year ago, summer of last year. And what does it do? It offers a tax credit if people make a donation of money to any of the programs that provide scholarships for parents to send their kids to charter schools, private schools, other kind of school choice. And then you get a tax credit in response for doing that. So does it cost the states any money? Nope. All the state has to do is opt in. 30 states have opted in to the Education Freedom Tax Credit. Do you know which ones haven't? All of the West Coast. Oregon, Washington, and California have all chosen not to opt in. In fact, Jared Polis is the only Democrat governor who's chosen to opt in to the Education Freedom Tax Credit. Shame on Tina Kotek and shame on Bob Ferguson for refusing to do this and benefit the children in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. Instead, it's funded by citizens, backed up by a tax credit from the One Big Beautiful Bill, which the governors of Oregon and Washington and California refuse to have anything to do with. Why? Because they hate Donald Trump. There is no other reason than that. Now, what happens when you hate Donald Trump more than you love the children of your state? I do want to mention this as well. The state of Washington is once again looking for a transgender doctor. Not actually a doctor who is transgender himself or herself, but a doctor who can oversee the medical mutilation of convicted criminals who want to change from boy to girl or girl to boy. And actually, the job seems to pay pretty well. I looked at the job listing today. I'm not qualified, nor would I be interested in the job if I were qualified. Salary at the Department of Corrections, $208,000 to $280,000, plus benefits, plus retirement, plus vacation, plus paid holidays. And all you have to do is, quote, act as the primary consultant for transgender care. You have to oversee all the hormone treatment of convicted criminals who want to switch to, from boy to girl or girl to boy. Oh, and also the evaluation and support of pre- and post-surgical care. So when the doctors start snipping off parts or adding parts on, you're in charge of that. Any surprise that the state of Washington Department of Corrections is having a tough time filling that doctor job? Back in a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure, and this is kind of a signature day, because Angelita Murillo is the only member of the Portland City Council, including the mayor, who's actually willing to come on this show and talk about a fairly important issue. It's a multi-hundred-million-dollar issue involving the Moda Center. So, City Council Member Murillo, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Lars.
Congrats for having the guts to come on. So there are some questions you want to get answered, and I want to give you your shot at this first before I ask you some of my questions about why we're doing this with the Moda Center and why we're offering up two-thirds of $1 billion of taxpayer money to benefit mostly a billionaire.
Yeah, we have a lot of questions about that at City Council, and unfortunately a lot of them are going unanswered. So I think there's a lot of common cause here for regular people to get behind good governance and good public oversight.
Okay, so what are the things you want to know? You want a detailed report that lists out a bunch of information. Tell my audience what that is.
Yeah, so right now the state, city, and county are in this committed deal to get the Blazers and Tom Dundon a bunch of public dollars to do this renovation, but City Council so far has not even received anything beyond what they described as concepts of a plan in their own testimony of what the architectural changes are going to be to the Moda Center. So we are asking for just basic information about what are the renovations going to be? Is this going to be public safety upgrades to make sure the building doesn't fall down in an earthquake? Is it going to be luxury box seats for other billionaires who come and visit the city? What are they going to be used for? And we are not really receiving any of these details as elected officials that are supposed to be representing the public interest. So I think that should be the bare minimum, in my opinion, when they're asking for taxpayer dollars.
Okay, I'm talking to Angelita Murillo, who's a member of the Portland City Council, and she tells me that is the way you pronounce it, not Murillo, but Murillo. Tell me this. I want to go back in time a little bit before the current 12-member City Council. Does anybody on the council now know why 2 years ago this summer Mayor Ted Wheeler decided to buy the Moda for a dollar and put the city, on the hook for all these costs?
I think that would be a great question for Councillor Dan Ryan, who used to be Commissioner Dan Ryan at the time. He was the only councillor that sat on the council at that time who approved that deal. But I think that the city has a long history of touting these public-private partnerships. But in reality, the city tends to make these deals with derelict buildings that are in need of millions of dollars of repair. And then we are on the hook for those repairs later on in ways that are really damaging and unhelpful to. So I think that is something that as a city councilor, I would certainly be looking into before making the city get into any commitments this large.
I got to tell you, Ms. Morello, you sound like a conservative to me, at least in that part of your comments. So good for you.
I think I sound like a sewer socialist.
A sewer socialist?
Uh-huh. Sewer socialists focus on good governance, oversight of public dollars, and issues that impact everyday people. And I think that a lot of, you know, frankly, across the aisle, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, have not really been digging into the sort of accountability for public dollars that they should be. So I appreciate that we're having a moment where we're seeing eye to eye on something. I think that's nice.
No. On this one, we do. Let me ask you a couple of tough questions. Why is there any obligation whatsoever to fix this place up at Tom Dundon's demand? Why does the city feel obligated to spend a whole bunch of public money to do this? Can you tell me?
Yeah, from Tom Dundon's perspective and from the NBA's perspective, Tom Dundon is threatening to take the Blazers and move them to another city unless we concede to do every renovation that he wants. He is refusing to put forward even a cent of his own money into this private investment, frankly. We are also not being given any evidence that he is necessarily going to move the team. It's highly uncommon for someone to purchase a sports team and then not contribute at least some part of their private dollars to an investment like this. In every other city that has had a renovation for a stadium of this size, the owner has contributed millions of dollars as well. So this is very unprecedented, and we are certainly being given the short end of the stick. Of course, the Blazers are a deeply important thing to the culture of Portland, and so people really care about that from an emotional lens. And then there's also the financial aspect where they're threatening that the entire city will collapse if we don't give up all of our public dollars to this billionaire, no questions asked.
Okay, well, Councilmember Morell, let me ask you this. If you say, no, we're not doing it, Dundon, you want to do it, fix the place up yourself, and he says, then I'll move the team, I'm told the NBA is going to charge him somewhere between $850 million and $1 billion, which sounds like a lot more expensive than, say, putting $500 million into Moda. Why doesn't the city council just say, hey, it's yours to fix up, make it a tenant improvement? Otherwise, if you want to move and pay the NBA $1 billion, go right ahead. Call his bluff.
That's a great question for some of my other colleagues, I think. That's the question that I've been asking myself.
What would you say if you were asked that question? Would you think we ought to call his bluff?
I think we do have to call his bluff. And I think that we also need to be prepared for the fact that he may not be a rational economic actor, right? He may move the team out of spite, even if it's a worse deal for him. But that doesn't mean that the NBA Board of Commissioners is going to agree with him. They care about their own finances as well. And so the reality is that right now, the best place for the Blazers to be financially and culturally is Portland. So I think that we have a responsibility to do as much digging as possible and call that bluff. We can't be negotiating from a place of weakness. And unfortunately, I think that the very early negotiations that Mayor Wilson did put us in a place of weakness as far as negotiations go.
So just so I'm clear, if the vote came up today and it was, look, we're going to call his bluff and tell him, no, we're not doing any of this. We're not spending all this public money, or we are going to do it. Which would your vote be?
If I had to vote on the term sheet as it's written right now with none of the amendments that we brought forward, I would be a no vote on it because it does not include anything that is for the public good. And from the calculations that me and my team did, we're not even going to make up the money from the so-called economic investments that are going to come in based on what we are putting forward. So it's a terrible deal for Portland. And yeah, I would be a no on the current term sheet. Absolutely.
And let me ask you something. It doesn't get talked about a lot. What do the Blazers currently pay in rent? Isn't it $1 a year?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
Well, they're the tenant in your facility. Do you know what you're getting out of it and what you would get out of it under the deal?
We're not getting any rent under the new term sheet. I think that's part of the problem, right?
Get most of the concessions revenue and most of the parking revenue, right? So you've got a tenant who gets everything and you just have to pay the bill?
Correct. You'd be surprised how many people become tenants' rights advocates when it's a billionaire that owns the building, or when a billionaire owns the team, though.
Okay, fair enough. Anything else you think my audience ought to know to understand this? And will you come back again? Because there are probably thornier issues that you and I could talk about, too.
Well, I'm not afraid to have those hard discussions. I think it's important, and I'm South American, so South American people aren't afraid of conflict. But, yeah, I think that, you know, we're doing our best to get as much information as possible when it comes to this deal and making sure that it's good for Portlanders. I brought forward an amendment that we're going to be discussing this evening at the City Council meeting that would give us a report for City Council 30 days beforehand, and it will actually identify the opportunity cost for each funding source.
That sounds very good. Ms. Murillo, thank you very much. That's Angelita Murillo, member of the Portland City Council, still debating about it. It's on the agenda tonight. Your quits or that shower.
On the go? Can't listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. In past years, we've been proud to take this show on the road to an awful lot of county fairs around the Pacific Northwest. We used to go to the Deschutes County Fair in Central Oregon. We'd go to the Douglas County Fair in Southern Oregon. And we would usually go to my home stomping grounds where I went to high school in Tillamook for the Tillamook County Fair. And that's where we find Max Sherman, who's the Republican nominee for Oregon House District 32, representing communities along Oregon's North Coast. Max, welcome to the program. You're at the fair right now, aren't you?
Yes, I am. So if there's a little bit of background noise, I'm trying to walk away from a little bit of it, but I think we got her covered.
I'm not worried about it at all. So tell me this. You're the nominee for House District 32. Should you get into the legislature, what do you want to get done for citizens?
Well, I think there's a few things we need to work on. One of the biggest is the unaffordable issue in our state and the insane over-the-top regulations and restrictions that our businesses are feeling. We have a state budget that's grown by over 100% in the last 10 years. Household incomes have gone up 50%, and that's something that's just simply not sustainable. So we need to hold state agencies, especially like ODOT, accountable for the dollars that they're entrusted to, and just look at the regulatory burden that's driving businesses out of our state left and right. I taught agriculture here at Tillamook High School. Work closely with the dairy industry, and feel the frustration many of them are dealing with on a daily basis, just with our overburdensome government.
So what's the chance of actually getting cut back? Because I don't think we have to look too far away. You look at Idaho. Idaho right now is reducing its tax rates, and they're seeing a tremendous boom in business. And they've kept tax rates low to begin with, and now they're getting them even lower, and yet they're still delivering the services that citizens expect. Why is it that it seems Salem and Olympia just claim they are constitutionally incapable of delivering without just jacking up taxes every 15 minutes?
Yeah, well, that's a good question that everybody needs to be asking, you know. And I've been involved with Oregon Farm Bureau, other groups. I've been in Salem during sessions for the better part of the last 40-plus years, you know, and when I talk to businesses, and for example, earlier this year I was in a hearing with ODOT, and two of the contractors that build the bridges and build the roads were talking that Oregon is literally the worst state on the entire Western United States to do business with, because again, the overburdening regulations, the oversight, the endless studies that are required, the delays that take place, you know, tell me someplace else where we can spend, you know, $450 million and study a bridge over the Columbia River for 16 years.
And by the way, that same agency you were talking to is the one that told the legislature we can build the Abernathy Bridge for a quarter of a billion, $250 million. And then it went to $500 million. and now it's north of 800, and they still aren't even done with the darn thing yet, and it's already more than tripled in price. And everybody in Salem just seem, they shrug and say, yeah, that's the way it works. Nobody gets fired. Yeah. Nobody gets disciplined. Why is it that, nobody ever sees a consequence? I mean, if I went to my boss and said, hey, I can do this new technology for $25,000, and then by the time I was done with it, it cost triple that, you can better believe my, boss would have something to say to me, maybe even hand me a pink slip.
Yeah, you'd be looking for a new job, you know, and, you know, that's one of the questions I'm going to be asking in Salem. We need to be holding these agencies accountable. There needs to be some serious questions asked on how they do business. I mean, I've built several barns and greenhouses, extensively remodeled two houses, built a house. I've had some surprises along the way, but I've never had anything come in at 400% over budget. You know, and that's something that we just simply need to, you know, to say, hey, enough is enough. You know,
and yet, and yet the opposition party, the Democrats, don't seem willing to hold Tina Kotek or Kate Brown's feet to the fire and say, why aren't you doing something differently about this, like firing some people or moving in some people to make different different decisions for you?
Yep. You know, and that's why we have to make some progress in Salem. You know, we have to break the supermajority. You know, I'm under no illusion that, I mean, I'm going to be there in a minority party, but if we break the supermajority, that gives us some power to force some negotiations. If we get Christine Drazen in the governor's office, again, that's going to force compromise, you know, so it's going to be little steps like that where we can make some differences, you know, and hopefully start making some change. I mean, we've been on this slide for 20 years. We're not going to turn it around tomorrow, but we've got to stop it, and we've got to start moving the needle in the other direction, you know, and I think we've got a good shot at doing that. You know, I think in particular the this last transportation package really woke people up. You know, when we had 80% of the testimony submitted was against it, you know, then we had our own current representative vote for it, give them the final vote to, you know, move it on in the House.
Yep.
You know, and then we collected, I collected signatures, you know, and I mean, I had ODOT people signing the petition, you know,
well, and
they
and
talked about the frustration.
I mean, Max, I'm talking to Max Sherman. By the way, before I forget, Max, where's the website where people can find out more about your campaign for Oregon House District 32?
Yeah. Basically, just look for Max Sherman for Oregon. And my Facebook page, or actually my website will pop up, or on Facebook, again, Max Sherman for Oregon, and you know, it'll take you right to it.
Well, and the very fact that you've got a governor in Tina Kotek who's been abandoned by her labor union buddies, abandoned by the teachers, abandoned by all these other people, and then when Christine Drazen says yes, she wasn't my first choice, but she is the Republican nominee, and I respect that, when she says, I will debate, and Tina Kotek simply says, well, I'm not going to debate. She's not going to face any questions. You know, can you imagine the arrogance of somebody who says, I'm Queen Tina. Nobody debates me. I'm not going to submit to a debate. I mean, I don't understand why she's still governor at this point or why her own party tolerates that kind of arrogance. That's Max Sherman. He's running for the Oregon House District 32, and he is the Republican. I'd be glad to talk to the Democrat, but I have a feeling they won't come on the air. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Your host,
quiet please,
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. So how about this for a way to start talking about a conspiracy theory? How about this? One voter, two ballots in the mail. And if election officials can't get that right, how much of the entire system should we trust at all? I'm going to get to an interview here with a young lady who reached out to me about what had happened to her, and then I'll get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Karen Frederick joins me now. Ms. Frederick, welcome to the program, and thanks for sending me an email describing what you got at election time. Ms. Frederick? Did we lose Karen Frederick already? No, we can't have had that happen. Let me see if we can get her back on. Karen, are you there? Joel, will you check on the status of Karen and find out what happened, because I'm not sure where she disappeared to. But it appears that she's not on that line. So maybe she thought we had bumped the interview to a different time. But what she had written to me about was, she said, have you ever received two or more ballots in the mail? The barcodes are not identical, but they are technically not duplicates, but that's what happened to her. Okay. Karen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So I told my audience that you got two ballots in the mail. Tell me when and how this happened.
Well, I pulled the ballots from my P.O. box several weeks ago, and I was in a hurry, of course, and just threw all the mail into my basket where I go to get it when I need it. So I thought I saw two ballots.
Did she just disappear again? Holy cow, that is not going to be fun at all. Let me see. I don't know if she's going on hold because of something that's happening at her end or our end, but I really want to hear her story about how she got two ballots, not the same barcodes on them. And, of course, the barcodes have a lot of people confused. Joel, if we can resolve that, get her on. But she says, I imagine they could somehow declare one of them to be invalid. I only discovered them both late yesterday after going through my old mail trying to find my ballot. Well, of course, Election Day was earlier this week, Tuesday, and you had to have your ballot in by then. Ms. Frederick, I apologize. I don't know where the interruption is happening, but you were describing how you found the ballots and then you realized you had duplicate ballots that had both come to you as a voter, right?
Yes. I mean, I've been very busy, like a lot of us people. I'm a business owner. I work 12 hours a day. On August 4th, around 6, I went to get my ballot. I saw there were two of them. I opened them both, and they appear to have different barcodes. They have the same address. So I was a little concerned that the one I chose to fill out and submit would not be valid for some reason. But I went ahead and voted.
Did they both have your name on it spelled the same way on both ballots?
Yes, same address.
Wow.
So when I called the Clark County Elections Office, they said, well, you recently moved. And I said, yes, I did. I moved 3 blocks away from my other previous address, but I've always used my P.O. box, and that has been always what's printed on the ballot. They said, well, I said, well, is one of these not valid? And the lady said, well, technically one of them is not valid. I said, but how will I know if I filled out the right one? It was really confusing. And so I said, you didn't show my new address on here, just the P.O. box. So they were basically identical. And it was just really confusing for me, I think.
Karen, did they indicate to you that the reason you got a second ballot was because when you moved, I assume you went to Department of Licensing and also changed your driver's license. Did you do that?
Yes.
Okay, and did they indicate that would have generated a new registration for voting, even though you already had your old registration that was going to a P.O. box?
Yes, and I did receive a new voter's registration card in the mail that still had my P.O. box printed on it, so it doesn't really make any sense. Since they sent these out weeks ago, and I received them on the same day. So I don't understand it, but I just wanted to let other people know that what's going on.
Yeah, and were you able to get any kind of satisfaction from talking, and you were talking to people at Department of Licensing, or you were talking to people at the elections headquarters?
Elections office. I just called there this morning.
Okay, and what have they told you more about why this would have happened, and is this a common problem? Because if every time people move and they update their driver's license, their new address, it generates a brand new voter registration, but it comes on top of the already existing voter registration, that doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. I did ask, what if I had used both ballots? Oh, one of them would have been invalid, she said. I just don't understand why two were sent out. That just stinks. It doesn't make sense. So I don't know how many others have experienced this.
Well, and in fact, I'd almost wonder, how would they know that one of the ballots was invalid if they sent them and they both had different barcodes on them, but they both had your name on them? But you could have two Karen Fredericks. You could have Karen Frederick Jr. and Sr. living at the same address. You could have John Jones Jr. and Sr. living at the same address. So they wouldn't, you wouldn't necessarily say just because it's a ballot going to somebody with the same name at the same address that it's a duplicate ballot. It could be a junior, couldn't it?
Correct.
But they couldn't tell you why, and they left you in the dark as to why this problem happened, or did they indicate that they thought it was a problem?
Oh, they didn't indicate they thought it was a problem. And I've had problems in the past where in 2008 I didn't receive a ballot, and I barely got the ballot on time to vote. And then in 2012, they indicated to me that I was a Skamania County resident when I've lived in downtown Washougal for a long time. So I said, you need to straighten this out. It looks very fishy. So I don't really understand. No, I wasn't given a satisfactory answer. I don't understand the reasoning behind generating two identical ballots with different barcodes.
You know, my suggestion, Karen, would be this.
Yes.
That when you say, who's in charge of elections? You say, well, the Secretary of State and the Elections Office in every county. And then you say, so they're the only ones who generate registrations? No. Most of the voter registrations are done by the Department of Licensing, which has no specific expertise or no specific authority to act on elections. And yet they're the ones who generate the registrations as voters, and they throw them into the system. And then when the elections office says, we don't know why this is happening, well, because you've given that responsibility to a different state agency that has no authority to do elections at all. Karen, thanks very much. I appreciate you telling that story. In a moment, protesters take over part of a city in Madison in Wisconsin, and city leaders are letting it happen. Is this another Chaz-style warning about socialism for America? That's next. For commercial property, what a...
Local, national, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and I saw the beginnings of a great conspiracy theory, and it has to do with a city in which an entire neighborhood has been taken over by people who are protesting. What are they protesting? They're protesting enforcement of the law. And you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of several years ago in the city of Seattle. I don't make my home in the city of Seattle, but in the city of Seattle, they had an area that was originally called the Chop Zone, and then they called it the Chaz Zone. And what it was a giant protest, the same kind of circumstances that are happening in Wisconsin right now that I'm going to tell you about in just a moment. And what was the result? They were protesting against the city and about the enforcement of laws and about the police and about allegedly fascism and everything else. And what did they do? Well, they ended up murdering a bunch of people. People died. People were denied law enforcement. And in fact, the very same people who were complaining in Seattle several years ago about enforcement of the law, One of the first things they did after they sectioned off about six square blocks of an American city and declared it the CHOP or CHAZ zone, they immediately cobbled together their own informal vigilante law enforcement group. So the very thing they were complaining about was one of the first things they ended up doing, except in their case, they didn't have a legislature made up of representatives who decided what the laws would be. The laws ended up being whatever the group in charge said, and whoever had the guns was deciding what the rules were going to be. It was that ugly. Well, the same kind of thing is going on right now in a place called Madison, Wisconsin. And I want to talk about that, and I'll refer to some really great reporting by a guy by the name of Daniel Lennington. I don't know Daniel Lennington, but his reporting about Madison is fantastic. First, though, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our poll on X. We put up a brand new poll question every day. It's found two places on X, on our X account, at Lars Larson Show, and on our website at LarsLarson.com. But I love the way Daniel Lennington led into this, because I'm an admirer of James Madison. Now, if you don't know, Madison lived just down the road from Thomas Jefferson in Charlottesville, Virginia, way back in the day. And they were two of the primary authors of the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution. He points out James Madison wrote that government owes citizens a, quote, debt of protection and must never permit, quote, arbitrary seizures of property, personal safety, and personal liberties from one class of citizens for the service of the rest of the class of citizens. Now, I think that makes perfect sense. The debt of protection that government is owed to citizens, and yet Lennington points out in a city named for this founding father, Madison, Wisconsin, citizens have been harassed by roving bands of socialists while city officials not only acquiesce, but they overtly support the seizure of property, the restriction of free movement, and the abuse of private businesses. So in other words, the very same thing I described to you a moment ago that was going on several years ago in Seattle, Washington, where you have a group of people who are angry about enforcement of the laws, so they take over part of the city. They then restrict and steal from the people who already live in that neighborhood. And believe me, people living in the CHOP or CHAZ zone in Seattle when that all that was going on, their liberty and their safety was very much at risk. So Lennington points out, the saga in Madison, Wisconsin began July 22, so not even a month ago. Four Madison police officers attempted to arrest Corey Ruiz, who was reportedly armed with a knife. A bunch of videos showed Ruiz resisting arrest and lunging at the officers until one of the police officers finally shot and killed him. According to the police, Ruiz pulled out his knife and injured an officer before he was shot. Now, this guy who died, he had been a criminal for 17 years. He'd been charged with 86 separate crimes, including 11 charges of resisting or obstructing officers, 14 charges of bail jumping, 12 charges of disorderly conduct. Those are the most frequently charged crimes. He was also arrested multiple times for battery, strangulation, vehicle theft, cocaine possession, threats to a judge, threats to a prosecutor, and threats to a cop. His criminal career showed profound disrespect for and violence toward law enforcement. So he ended up dead. Not a big surprise. I mean, you almost could have predicted it looking at his history and say, how do you think that guy's going to end up? Well, he's going to get into a beef with cops and he's going to end up dead at some point. Now, the officers involved in Madison, Wisconsin were white. Ruiz was black, although in five separate court records, they list this Corey Ruiz as a Caucasian. That raises a whole other question of how you defend people. But the community in Madison, Wisconsin, which is very political, they decided a man has died at the hands of state-sanctioned violence. Say it. Say his name. This state-sanctioned violence was an execution. So, of course, they're getting everybody riled up about a guy who was a longtime criminal, 17 years of crimes, 86 separate charges, and they form now the Corey Ruiz Autonomous Zone, known as the Crazy. Great. The city itself is actually supporting its own occupation by this group. They have installed barricades to protect the Corey Ruiz Autonomous Zone, or CRAZ. Officials have informed citizens that the area will be closed until further notice. Porta potties have appeared to support the occupation. The city denies supplying those. And citizens are unable to move in and out of that area. In other words, all the things that Madison talked about being an obligation of government to its citizens are now being denied to the citizens in the town of Madison, Wisconsin, that has his name. And this, according to Daniel Pennington, and I think he's right, is a preview of a socialist America. Many of the organizers, protesters, and campers, as well as gubernatorial candidate Hong, are self-described socialists. They are no different from the socialists in New York, in Michigan, in Minnesota, and elsewhere in America. I'd even point out Seattle, Washington, now has a socialist mayor. So if you want a view of what's likely to happen in this country when the socialists take over, take a look at New York City, take a look at Seattle, and then take a look at what's happening in Madison, Wisconsin. Back in a moment. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larsen Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather station. FM's Larsen Show on X at Lars Larsen Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larsen Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larsen Show. I want to remind you of something. 31 American warriors died in the deadliest day in naval special warfare history 15 years ago. Are their names going to survive for the next 15, and will remember the great sacrifices made by them? Well, one of the people who's endeavoring to make sure that that does not happen, that we do not forget those names, is Don Brown, former U.S. Navy JAG officer, that's Judge Advocate General Office officer, and national security expert, and the author of a book called Call Sign Extortion 17. Mr. Brown, welcome to the program, and thanks for your service in uniform.
Boris, thanks for having me back, and thanks for taking a moment to remember these brave Americans who gave their lives on this really solemn day 15 years ago today. I really appreciate you doing that more than you know.
Would you mind, and listen, I'm glad to do it, and I've read about this. I mean, I read about it when it happened. I read about it in the aftermath as there were various reports on it. But you had all of these warriors who were on board a helicopter, Chinook, CH-47, that answered a call for help, and they got hit by an RPG. Describe for my audience what happened that day.
Yeah, well, that was the official, you know, military claim is that they answered a call for help. We're not sure that really happened. There were 31.
You think that
Americans
may have been a little bit of military fiction to support some other mission they were involved in?
Well, my book, Call Sign Extortion 17, basically rips a hole in the official military report. I believe these service members were either deliberately sacrificed by our government, or their deaths were the result of absolute criminal negligence based upon rules of engagement that were in place during the Obama administration at the time. There were 17 members of SEAL Team 6, or DEVGRU, the most elite military unit in the United States military, on board this chopper. And this mission took place August 6, 2011. 96 days after SEAL Team 6 had taken out Osama bin Laden on May 1st. And the Taliban was looking for an excuse. And this chopper took off at about 2:22 a.m. local time there from FOB Shank at Logar Province on a mission that should have been 10 minutes wheels up to wheels down. But as it got over the landing zone, it seemed to stall or a hooper in the air. Stall is in the exact room, but we couldn't communicate with it. It was hanging in the air. We got strange messages from it. 7 minutes after it should have been on the ground, it was blown out of the sky. And we were getting messages from the inside. There were seven Afghans who were switched out at the last second and put on this chopper one question after another has arisen from the shootdown. There was never a black box recovered. The only time the U.S. Army Pathfinder said they could not recover a black box in the hour and a half between the shootdown and the official report of Americans arriving, that is a Ranger unit, we discovered that an unidentified, you know, coalition unit went on to the ground. And we discovered that when I wrote the book to expose it, circled the area and left. So there are more questions than answers. We pulled the bodies, or the autopsies of three bodies, and found bullets in the bodies, which indicates possible firefight on board. We don't know if this green on blue.
I was going to say green on blue incident, so an inside job involving those Afghans who inserted at the last moment?
Yeah, we can't rule that out, Lars. We don't have the answers. My book raises all the questions, and it was written the number of strange things. This shootdown took place August the 11th. Within 60 days, basically, the military had wrapped up the investigation. James Mattis, at that time, who was Central Command commander, later to be Secretary of Defense under Trump and later to be relieved by Trump, should have never been hired to begin with, sent a Brigadier General, Jeffrey Colt, to investigate. They wrapped this up very quickly, and as the General Colt was briefing family members there in Little Creek, Virginia, which is where SEAL Team 6 is headquartered, we had senior chiefs and master chiefs walking through the families and passing out these discs. And on the disc, Lars, there was 1,250 pages of the investigation of the accident, which had been, I should say, the shootdown, which had been strangely declassified within a period of like 60 days. Wow. And Lars, normally you don't get the classifications for half a century, 50 years or more. I mean, Trump is just now declassifying some of the JFK materials.
Somebody, so why was this declassified so quickly? What would have motivated that, or was it part of a cover-up?
Well, I'm convinced that the reason it was declassified, and this is one of the great mysteries, is somebody wanted the truth out, probably senior and master chiefs who knew that these guys had been shot down and killed, 31, and not just 17 members of SEAL Team 6. We had five members of U.S. Naval Support, EOD guys, cryptologists, three U.S. Air Force special operators who were pararescue guys, five members of the National Guard flight crew. Somebody knew or believed, in my opinion, these guys had been set up. They wanted the truth out. And so my book is written based upon that. A docudrama movie was released in 2021 called Fallen Angel. The studio has now pulled that offline because there's going to be a re-release, hopefully, in not too distant future with additional information that we have received since the original docudrama was put out. But I think somebody knew that this is a sham job. This is essentially a sacrifice. SEAL Team 6 should never have been flying a mission like this to begin with. The official military report said it was to go after a mid-level Taliban operative. And, you know, I was giving a PowerPoint presentation in the mountains of North Carolina after the book came out. And after I finished, a guy came up to me and said, "This doesn't make sense." I said, "What do you mean?" Well, this fella named Colonel Pete McElwain had been the CIA station chief in Afghanistan at the beginning of the war. He said, first of all, he told me something that I didn't know. The CIA, even though I'd written the book, I didn't know the CIA had taken operational control of SEAL Team 6 at the beginning of the Afghan war. And he said, "We would never send DEVGRU or SEAL Team 6 on a mission for a mid-level Taliban operative." So they were
reserved only for the biggest and most important targets, right?
The very top of the targets in the war on terror. That's correct. Which is why they were selected to take out Osama bin Laden himself. You're absolutely correct. The one question after the other. So anyway, my goal is not only to try to get answers, and I've become close to a number of the family members, but also to honor these guys and honor their memory. They are the best of the best, and you know, we just can't let their memory fade into oblivion. We've got to remember them every day.
No, we've absolutely got to do that. Hey, I really appreciate your time, and of course, I appreciate your service in uniform. That's Don Brown, former U.S. Navy JAG officer, national security expert, and the author of Call Sign Extortion 17, about what happened 15 years ago today, the deaths of 31 members of our military, including members of SEAL Team 6. I'll be back for you. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-866-866- 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LawrenceLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. About selling your home in today.
Take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at the Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I wanted to mention this first before I talk to our guest. My email of the day, and you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Michael Siddick wrote in, and I thought he was very short and very to the point. Wouldn't Social Security funding, which is due to run short in about 2034, if not 2033, wouldn't it be solved by using the penny method, the flat rate COLA concept? He's talking about the idea that you could balance the federal budget if you simply told all the federal agencies, you've got to get by on 99 cents on the dollar you had in your budget last year, and then 98 cents the next year. In 5 years, you've actually balanced the federal budget. The reason that that would not work for Social Security is that we're so late in the game. We've only got a few years left before the trust fund is due to run so short that they're going to have to cut almost everybody's benefits by 25% or raise taxes dramatically or something. But they have to figure out something. The penny plan might have worked if they had flattened out the cost of living adjustment, the COLA, a number of years ago. But this is so late in the game, I don't think it would have that effect. Now, Dr. Barbara Call joins me now, who's the Republican nominee for Oregon's 1st Congressional District for 2026. She'll be running against the incumbent Democrat, Suzanne Bonamici. Dr. Call, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Lars. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I understand you're at the Tillamook County Fair. We've done the fair with the show live in many occasions. We're not doing it this year. But tell me what your appeal is going to be to the voters in the 1st Congressional District about why they should replace Suzanne Bonamici with you and send you back to Capitol Hill.
Well, I will tell you, one of the big things that's really upfront and personal right now is the forest fires that are going on in our federal forests that trickle down into our state forests. I don't know if anyone is aware that there are multiple bills that had been presented in Congress to help clean up our forests, create healthy forests, harvest the forest. Every single time one of those went to Congress, she voted no. And we are living, and those people in Sanko and Eastern Oregon are living with the disaster that could have been prevented at the federal level.
Now, did she ever explain why she would vote no? I don't think there is a good explanation, but did she offer up any kind of reasoning as to why you'd vote against something as sensible as that?
No. I do know that there's a lot of environmentalists that are tracking her and support her, and I don't know if that is part of the reasoning. But me, I love the environment. I'm a lifelong Oregonian. I don't want our environment harmed, but neglecting forests does just the opposite. It harms them quite a bit.
Well, I mean, think about it, Dr. Call. How much harm is done to the air quality? How much carbon is dumped in? I mean, if you're one of those people who believes that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and a poison, I'm not one of those. But even if you believe that, imagine how much carbon in the last 6 weeks has been shot into the atmosphere of planet Earth by all these fires, which we don't have every year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a disaster, as you know. And we could have done a lot better if she were not the one that is taking control of our federal forest for Oregon. So, you know, that's just one of the things that's out there.
The other thing I'd love to see you do in line with that is the U.S. Forest Service is 30,000 employees. And the Forest Service used to generate, because it's part of the Department of Agriculture, the forests that America owns are absolutely extraordinary. 198 million acres of forest nationwide. all of it owned by the American people and allegedly managed by the Forest Service. The problem is it used to be a net contributor to the U.S. Treasury. Today, it's a net drain on the federal budget. I would think that the very least you could do is say to the Forest Service, you have to make your operation a net positive for America at the very least. I mean, ideally, you would set it up to be the true multiple use that the Forest Service always was, instead of being a giant agency that costs more money than it actually makes every year.
Absolutely. I think if I can get into Congress, working with President Trump and the Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service, that we can make a lot of changes that will bring that economy back to our forests. I agree with you wholeheartedly on that.
So tell my audience how they can find your website and find out more about your positions on all the issues.
They can find me at drkahlforcongress.com. That's D-R-K-A-H-L for Congress.com. You can see me at Twitter at Dr. Call with the number for Congress, or on Facebook at Barbara Call for Congress. Any of those sites, I generally post daily.
Okay, and what are the other major issues you want to take on should you become a member of Congress?
Should I? Well, I'm hoping that I will. Definitely we need to reestablish academic rigor in our schools. We have been lacking significantly. Of course, as you know, Oregon is 50th. Now, while I can't do things at the state level, I certainly can help instigate that rigor at the federal level and work with the Secretary McMahon and make sure that our schools are tracking the right direction, bring some trades in because not everybody wants to go to college. We need to get our trades back out there. I know that we're losing a lot of foresters. We're losing kids that, you know, that could go into welding or electrical work. I mean, those are top-paying jobs, and those don't get advertised to kids enough in schools. And so that's another area I'd really like to improve on. We also have, driving federal investment into areas around here. You know, our ports, literally, a port in Astoria literally fell off and into the river. That's how dated our ports are. They haven't had any improvement for over 70 years. And even though the money has been asked for several times, it's sitting waiting for regulations and permitting in order to repair those ports. But by the time we have the money in there to be able to do that, it's going to double or triple the cost that it would have been if those permits had been provided early on.
Unbelievable.
There's a lot that's out there.
Dr. Call, I wish you well, and I hope that you do replace Suzanne Bonamici. I don't think much of the current occupant of that seat in the 1st Congressional District, and I'd love to see you take her place. Thanks so much for coming on the program. By the way, this segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building up your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids up for success by creating a customized estate plan at eLegacy. Just go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. That's eLegacyLars.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. We're on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And I hope that our next guest will forgive me for constantly using one of his most recent purchases of a building as an example of how far down the city of Portland has fallen. I mean, real estate, commercial real estate in downtown Portland, which I have no direct investment in, but from a distance, it looks like a train wreck to me, losing about 70% of its value. And one of those properties in particular is the iconic building known as Big Pink, the U.S. Bancorp Tower, which was sold about a decade ago for about not quite $400 million. I may have rounded off from time to time to $400 million. It worked out to about $9 million a floor is what it cost. And then it was sold to Jeff Swickard for about $1 million a floor, if that gives you an idea of the kind of discount, because Jeff Swickard believes that he may be able to turn things around, at least when it comes to Big Pink. So the president and CEO of Swickard Group, Jeff Swickard, joins me now. Mr. Swickard, welcome to the program, and will you forgive me for using your purchase as an example of just how bad things have gotten in Portland? Mr. Swickard. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's check on that call, Joel, and see what's happened to that call. Yeah, the phone system has been giving Jeff or giving Joel fits lately. We'll see if we can get it fixed up because it's been developing some bugs today. And yes, we have filed a ticket with IT and we've filed a ticket with engineering. I'll tell you what, it's irritating. But Mr. Swickard, welcome back to the program. Sorry about the technical problem.
No, how are you?
Doing well, and I have used your purchase of Big Pink as an indication, not necessarily of an attitude about what you've been doing, but I've just said this gives you an idea. If a downtown where you buy a building for almost $400 million, you'd assume over 10 years, it'd probably go up in value 20, maybe even 30%. Instead, it dropped like a rock, and you picked it up for $45 million. But that says something about your belief about where Portland is capable of. Things go the right way. Am I right?
You are right. Yes, absolutely. I do think that properties, I mean, you know, certainly on the West Coast and, you know, property values in major metropolitan cities have been adjusted dramatically. And I think it's, you know, a variety of factors, but, you know, absolutely. I mean, I bought Big Pink more for personal reasons than, you know, from an investment perspective. I mean, as you know, I think you and I spoke before, you know, years ago, I was a University of Oregon student. So, you know, I've walked into Big Pink hoping someone would give me a chance. And so decades later, I had the opportunity to buy the same building. So for me, it's not just an investment. It's highly personal. So I kind of want the next generation of young people to walk into downtown Portland with kind of the same sense of opportunity that I left, you know, that I felt.
So what's it going to take from City Hall in particular to straighten out the various environmental factors? And by environment, I'm not talking about the global warming or CO2. I'm talking about crime. I'm talking about basically the effect that people have when they walk into downtown Portland and see graffiti and people who are camped out on the streets and things like that. What has to change to make your investment like that one and your other investments actually make sense?
I mean, that's a really compelling question. I think we need to measure outcomes instead of like intentions. Like, are more people working downtown? Are more businesses opening? Are fewer businesses leaving? Is crime down? Are office buildings filling up? You know, and if the answer is no, then we have to change the policy, right? So, you know, I think we should measure kind of these outcomes rather than, you know, some of the intentions. And I do think that some work is being done, and I think we are making progress. And so, you know, I'm optimistic about Portland.
What would it, okay, if you were on the city council, I take it you're not planning to run for a political position anytime soon, but if you were, or if you were the mayor, what could be done fairly easily that would help to straighten the situation out?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not a politician. I'm a business owner. I'm an employer. I'm an investor. But you know, I just believe the city is worth fighting for. And I think we've seen the consequences of some poor decisions. I mean, office values, like you said, have fallen dramatically. Businesses have left. Residents have lost confidence. But cities recover all the time, right? And the question isn't whether Portland can recover. It's whether we're willing to make different decisions so it can recover. So I think, I think if I was on the city council, I would, you know, again, you know, try to understand the metrics and the outcomes. And just if the outcomes are different than what we want, then we just have to do things differently.
See, and I don't disagree with any of that. I would love to see the city say we're going to put a focus on public safety. Not just tell us that it's going to be nicer, but actually, like you said, base it on outcomes, base it on how things actually change. And right now, I think that unfortunately, Keith Wilson, who's the mayor, he's been on this show before. He's not come back recently, although he promised to come back. And I would put him to him the question, if people don't feel safe in downtown Portland, why would they come to the place to do business? And why would you locate your business in a building in downtown Portland if they don't feel safe? And what are you going to do to change that? So far, I haven't seen much from him.
I mean, I think public safety shouldn't be political. It's like foundational. Like every successful city, you know, I think in the world understands that we have employees, customers, businesses can't thrive if they don't feel safe. I do think I have a lot of confidence in Chief Bob Day. I think he's a terrific police chief. I think that Portland should be thankful of his leadership every single day. And I think that the broader kind of conversation about crime is one that needs to be kind of front and center. I think that to your point, you know, businesses aren't going to return to downtown Portland or to any city for that matter, unless they're, you know, unless public safety is the public safety issues are resolved. So, but I do think there's progress. I do think that Mayor Wilson is, and I would hope that he'd come on your show again. And I think, I think he's got a lot of great ideas and, you know, and hopefully, you know, some of those can be implemented.
What are you going to do that's going to shock or surprise Portland in the next 12 months? I mean, I think you took people by surprise with Big Pink. Tell me one thing quickly before we run out of time that you're going to do.
Well, I'm going to continue to invest, which shocks, like, you know, everybody kind of around me. I think that to me, you know, Big Pink it's not just an office building. It's one of Portland's most recognizable landmarks. And so if we can demonstrate that Big Pink can thrive again, you know, through hospitality service investment, I think it sends a powerful signal that downtown can thrive again in general. So I'm going to continue to invest. I really, I think that, great cities aren't rebuilt by talking. They're rebuilt by investing. So, you know, I think that, we need people to feel more confident in downtown Portland.
Absolutely right. That is Jeff Swicker. Jeff is president and CEO of Swicker Group. We'll be back in just a moment. Mr. Swicker, thanks so much for your time. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Reading glasses everywhere.